and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the gamer and podcaster, Shalene Lopez. Shalene, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us what you've come on the show to talk about. Give us some context around it and its release, its reception. Tell us why it is maligned and why you think that that is wrong.
Okay, well, I came here today to talk about BioShock 2, which is not just the most reviled game in the BioShock series. It is one of the more reviled games that is talked about by gamers on the internet. People seem to really hate this game, which to me is crazy because I think it's possibly the best game in the series.
Why do you think that people do, you know, take against it like so much? Because it got fairly good reviews when it was released originally.
It did, and I believe it has a Metacritic of something like 88.
Wow.
Which is a very high score. But any time that you hear people talking about it on the internet, it's always just to bash it. They say, oh yes, that horrible, horrible BioShock 2 that nobody wanted. But it did have the good DLC.
That's true, yes, yes. We'll get on to that later. So, I mean, do you think that that's most people's problem with it? That this idea that, oh, nobody was asking for a sequel to BioShock, which, I mean, the original BioShock, for listeners who aren't aware, the original BioShock is generally regarded as one of the best video games ever. So do you think it was just that nobody, you know, the feeling was nobody asked for it and that it suffered in comparison to what was, you know, genuinely a really great video game?
Right. I think probably it's largely because Ken Levine was not involved in the creation of BioShock 2. I really think that made the difference. I think people didn't give it a chance. I think a lot of the people that bash it so much have never even really played the game. I think it's just on the basis of it being a different development team.
Right. This was developed by 2K Marin. I have to tread a little bit carefully here, as I know some of the people who were involved in making BioShock 2.
Right.
And worked at 2K Marin. But yes, it was a different team. Not 100% different. It's not like nobody involved had worked on BioShock 1 as well, but the majority of the team, as I understand it, yes, were not from, was it Boston, basically, wasn't it? 2K Boston, who
right.
developed BioShock, as you say, under Ken Levine. So when you tell people that you like BioShock 2, I mean, would you say that you prefer it to BioShock 1, or just that you think it's, you know, not as bad as people say?
Well, BioShock 1 is a very special thing. You said earlier it's considered widely to be a masterpiece among video games, and it's true. BioShock 1 was a very special game. But there are things about BioShock 2 that make it better than BioShock the original, and certainly better than BioShock Infinite, which is also a highly lauded game, but also very good. But I prefer BioShock 2 for several reasons, one of them being the gameplay. So do you know much about the BioShock series?
I did play BioShock 1. It was a long time ago. And I'll be honest, I didn't play BioShock 2 because I played BioShock 1 mainly because everybody, you know, because it was so lauded. And being a writer, naturally, people often sort of point me towards narrative to games with a good narrative. And BioShock
right.
1, I did enjoy the narrative. I liked the little twist with Andrew Ryan, etc. However, the actual gameplay, and especially the RPG-like aspects of it, I didn't enjoy. I'm not a big fan of this. And I know that that's Levine's thing, you know, player choice and all that sort of stuff. But I'm just not big on RPG aspects in pretty much any game, to be honest. I like pen and paper RPGs, but in video games, they bore me. So when BioShock 2 was released and the consensus seemed to be that it mainly went over old ground. And there were a lot of people who liked it, but nevertheless said, oh, it doesn't really do anything new. Then I didn't bother. I didn't play it. But let's assume that I and our listeners aren't familiar with the series. So give us some context around it. Tell us the background.
Okay, let's have a little BioShock, sort of a world of BioShock primer.
Excellent.
As it were.
Feel like it should have some theme music.
The world of BioShock is underwater It's sort of this underwater city called Rapture that was created by billionaire Andrew Ryan with the idea that the scientist would not be hindered by morality, the artist would not be censored, you know, the entrepreneur would have no constraints, and everyone could prosper or fail as they would on their own strength. And something that happened in this environment is that people unlocked the secret to splicing their genes and gained superpowers. But the gene splicing does come with a cost, and it was driving people crazy and mutating their bodies. And it ended up creating a sort of a race of mutant monsters with superpowers in this undersea city. And one of the big conceits in this game is the idea of the Big Daddy and the Little Sister. And the Little Sister is a construct that was a little girl who has been modified, genetically modified, to be able to process Adam, which is basically genetic material. And she takes a giant needle and harvests Adam from corpses, which she then processes through her own body via a nipple on the back of the little syringe gun that she has, which sounds horrible because it is. And the little sister is protected by the Big Daddy, who is a sort of genetically modified human in a giant mechanized suit, who protects the little sister because she is, of course, full of this Adam that she's harvesting from corpses. And the splicers, who are the people who have gone crazy splicing their genes and gaining superpowers, the splicers want this Adam, and they want to take it from this little sister by any means necessary. So the Big Daddy's job is to protect her. And in the first BioShock, they gave you the choice of harvesting the little sister for her Adam or saving her. And either way, you get Adam from this girl. But if you save her, you get far less Adam, and the game is harder. And this carries over into BioShock 2. But in BioShock 2, you actually play as a Big Daddy, one of the original Alpha Series Big Daddies, sort of a prototype, named Delta. And that's where you begin. You begin the game, you know, escorting your little sister, and then you are killed and resurrected by a scientist named Bridget Tenenbaum. And you find out that you are living in a rapture that is 8 years after the original BioShock, and you've been resurrected by Bridget Tenenbaum to help her rescue these new generation of little sisters that has been created. Bridget Tenenbaum created the original little sisters, and she's now looking for a chance to redeem herself.
Right. She's a character in the first game, isn't she?
Yes. Yes. So in BioShock 2, you encounter a much older and more regretful Bridget Tenenbaum.
Right.
Who's sort of guiding you along the way. And you play as Delta, who is a prototype Big Daddy. And Delta was bonded to a little sister named Eleanor. And this is a sort of a new bit of Big Daddy lore that's introduced in BioShock 2. The Alpha Series Big Daddies are bonded to a single little sister. And if they are separated from their little sister, they will die. One of the audio logs calls it a love that kills. So you are Delta, and you're trying to get back to your little sister, who is a girl named Eleanor, who happens to be the daughter of the antagonist of this game, Sophia Lamb. Sophia Lamb has taken over Rapture after the death of Andrew Ryan. Spoilers for BioShock. Yeah. There.
Spoilers for a 10-year-old game.
Exactly. And Sophia Lamb has taken over Rapture in the absence of Andrew Ryan, and she has remade it into a world that is not about the self, but is about family. And sort of the idea of compassion and helping each other and sacrificing the self for the good of the community, which sounds all well and good, but basically has just created wild mutant splicers that run in packs instead of on their own. And you're trying to get back to your little sister Eleanor because Sophia Lam has some nefarious plans for her. And even though it's her daughter, some nefarious plans. I suppose the story of this doesn't sound quite so spectacular.
Well, no, but you
in
know,
the telling.
Well, what story does? But no, it's the sort of sacrifices must be made, you know, in the for the sake of science at all costs attitude, mm-hmm. isn't it?
And it does sort of retread some of the same ground. You are back in Rapture. You do see some of the same old characters. But it is a more ruined city of Rapture. And that sort of Art Deco aesthetic is a ruined Art Deco and a more water-stained Art Deco. And I really feel like it's a very different feeling environment while also feeling sort of familiar. That's something that I liked about BioShock 2. It's a place that's familiar, but there's so many new things to explore, and exploration is really a strength of BioShock 2. There are tons of audio logs and lore expanding rooms that you can find, and it's a lot. So there's sort of a primer on the history of what the story is going on there.
Well, and talking about exploration, I mean, that's one of the things that the BioShock series, not that it started, but it is generally credited with sort of making very popular and making people aware of the concept of environmental exploration and environmental storytelling.
Absolutely.
Within video games, the idea that you don't just need a bunch of cutscenes of people telling you things to find story out, that you can build it up almost like a portmanteau story or something. You can build up a story from things you find yourself, like audio logs, like the state of the environment, like things that have clearly happened to the environment, and figuring out things that have happened in a room, you know, a year ago or something, by the detritus that remains there. Almost like detective work, if you like.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with that. And I think that's one of the things that's special to BioShock 2, is that it is more effective when you're not in combat. It is the most effective when you're wandering around and seeing these stories unfold, and what did happen here and what happened here after that, and judging by the evidence of the items that are left behind and the blood stains on the floor. And oh, it's very neat. The audio logs you can find. I greatly enjoy the audio logs of BioShock 2. I think they're highly superior to the audio logs of the other two games in the series. And speaking of environmental storytelling, the AI is much smarter in BioShock 2 than it is in the original BioShock. And they sort of do things that don't involve you. If you can sneak up on a group of splicers, you'll see them interacting with each other. Maybe these two are sacrificing a third splicer on a sort of makeshift altar. Or you might come across some splicers that are fighting over some items that you can kill them all and pick up the items for yourself. And I had a really funny experience when I was replaying the game. I was just walking through this area. It was sort of a display area, like a museum setup with some automatrons and voiceover. And there are darkened areas that you haven't walked through yet. And I'm walking through and listening to the audio as it plays, describing these different plasmids and their effects. And there's this group of four mannequins up next. I can see the shadowy outlines. And I walk up, and just before the lights kick on in that area, one of the mannequins jumps out of the display and is actually a splicer who is hiding there waiting for me.
Oh, wow.
And that was such a shock. It was a good jump scare, but it felt so realistic, like somebody might have actually done that in this world.
Right. It feels like the sort of thing that could happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that you, I didn't actually know that the society had kind of was being deliberately moved on into something that was more about family rather than the self, because, and this is, you know, again, this is only new to people who don't know anything about BioShock. It was very much the philosophy of the antagonist was very much grounded in the philosophies of objectivism and randism, And that became, you know, a big part of the storytelling around the game, of the plot, even, you know, without wanting to give away, I know we said spoilers for a 10-year-old game, but let's not give away everything about the first game in case people want to go out and play it after this. But, you know, there are significant plot twists and stuff that are tied into that philosophy. So it's interesting that for the sequel, they went completely in the other direction and created, you know, a sort of antithesis of that society, if you like, that, yes, focuses on community and family and sacrifice, self-sacrifice, rather than everything being about the power of the individual. It's almost like pitching capitalism against communism.
Exactly, exactly. And they definitely do cast this family in a very malicious light, because you playing as Delta are very much alone and very much, you know, doing what you can with your own abilities, your own powers by yourself. You know, you have very little support. And Lam will speak to you over the loudspeakers when she sees you getting near to your goal. And she says, you know, she'll address the family and she'll be like, you know, family, Delta is a monster and you must stop him. And they'll just all come swarming at you. And they definitely cast that in a very malicious light.
Right. Well, and one of the other themes of the first game was that no matter how idealistic something may be, you know, may be at its founding, there will always be class and society divisions will always occur. You know, yes. The original idea of Rapture, as you said, was that it was meant to be a haven for the elite where they could all live in peace and do whatever they wanted without society bothering them. But of course, in any closed environment or any environment at all, you're always going to get sort of divides of society and snobs and the development of what's perceived to be an underclass, which, you know, includes obviously the sort of the Splicers and, well, and the Big Daddies and the Little Sisters to an extent, because they are essentially, you know, sort of slaves.
And that's another thing. They do deepen the sort of story behind the Big Daddies and the Little Sisters in Bioshock 2, because you are playing as a Big Daddy yourself, you can still take out other Big Daddies who are not, you know, Alpha Series Big Daddies. The Alpha Series being a prototype is sort of closer to what they began as a human being, you know. They're sort of more human than the later Big Daddies. You can take out these later series Big Daddies and actually adopt the little sisters that they were escorting. And then you carry the little girl around on your shoulders and find corpses and protect her while she gathers Adam. And this is an optional part of the game. If you don't do it, though, it will make the game much harder. You can't really upgrade your plasmid superpower abilities. So you do, it is very helpful if you do that. And you can take her on two different gatherers and you set her down on a corpse and she gathers Adam. And you can actually set up traps. You have trap ammunition for the rivet gun, which is one of my favorite weapons in all of video games. I love the rivet gun. It has trap ammo that you can set up. You can hack nearby turrets and little sort of drones, little machine gun drones, and hack searchlights who will call in more little robot drones to help you. And you want to set all of this sort of thing up before you actually set that little sister down, because as soon as you set her down, you will be swarmed by Splicers who want to get her Adam. And that's it's a very deep sort of a gameplay mechanic. And there are even plasmids that offer trap versions that you can upgrade to and set up a bunch of traps just all around where this little sister will be gathering. And then you have to defend her while they come. And that's a really neat little gameplay aspect that I enjoyed very much in Bioshock 2. And you can take her on two gathers and then you take her to one of the vents that the little sisters like to crawl around in. And when you take her to the vent, you are still given the option, like in Bioshock 1, of saving her or harvesting her for her Adam. And if you save her, you just sort of suck out the Adam and she's safe. She's a normal little girl again. She's no longer this, you know, evil looking gene spliced creature. She's just a little girl and she's free and safe. If you harvest her, you basically cut her open to make sure you get out every bit of atom. So the little girl dies. And it sort of increases the moral dilemma because all that atom is really helpful, but you are a much more monstrous creature yourself if you're willing to kill this little girl that you just escorted around and protected. And, you know, it's sort of another wrinkle that they added onto the big daddy little sister relationship.
What is it, do you think, about dead-eyed, creepy little girls that is so pervasive in video game culture especially, but in sort of just horror culture?
Yeah, with the dress and the bow. You never see a dead-eyed, creepy girl in pants.
It's That's true. That's true.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's just that, you know, perversion of something that's supposed to be so innocent and good. There is a segment toward the end where Delta is, like, down for the count, and it looks very bad for him. And Eleanor gives him a plasmid that gives him the ability to actually take control of the little sister. And, you know, the little sisters are always, like, they have this sort of very trippy way of acting and talking. They sort of flit around Rapture, like, you know, we're going to see an angel, Daddy, and look at them dancing.
Right. They always reminded me, actually, of Delirium from the Sandman comic book, if you know that.
No, I'm not familiar with that.
Okay.
But when you take control of this little sister and see the world through her eyes, it's beautiful. It's unruined and everything's, you know, pink and glowing.
Oh.
And the corpse on the ground is this beautiful angel. And so they have a very different viewpoint, I suppose, as a result of everything that was done to them. I suppose that's what they had to do to get them, you know, down there harvesting Adam from these corpses. But
wow. Yeah. So that makes the whole sort of corruption of innocence thing even worse, really, doesn't it?
Yes, yes, because they're not only corrupted, they've also been lied to.
I'm sure there's a life lesson in there somewhere. One of the things that I liked about the first game, and I'm glad that it sounds like they kept a similar sort of thing for this one, is that sort of moral dilemma of you can choose either way. You know, the game won't penalize you as such for being bad, but you can choose either way. And if you choose to be good, you actually will make things harder for yourself. If you choose to be a friend to the little sisters, as you said, the game is harder because you can't get as much Adam from them, so you are making things more difficult for yourself. But you know, as people have played the game will know, you do get a better ending if you follow that path. But again, that's not in gameplay terms. That's purely in narrative terms. So I quite like that, you know, it doesn't penalize you gameplay-wise. It's not like suddenly the big bad guy at the end, and again, I'm trying to avoid spoilers here, of the first game, is harder to beat if you've been evil and harvested the little sisters, you know? I don't think there's any difference on that gameplay. You just get a different narrative ending. So I've always thought that was an interesting way of doing these sort of faux moral choices within a game where, yeah, taking the good path actually doesn't get you anything other than bragging rights, I guess. You know, the ability to say, actually, yes, I did follow the morally good path and, you know, completed the whole thing, even though that made it more difficult for myself.
Right. BioShock 2 is very similar in terms of that. It does change the ending based on whether or not you have saved or harvested little sisters, and also based on some other moral dilemmas that you face in the game with, I believe there are three characters that you meet that you can either show mercy to or destroy. And that sort of influences the hold that Sophia Lamb has on the city. You can spare some of her lieutenants, and they look at you and see your mercy and think, maybe we are being lied to by Lamb. And you can see her hold on Rapture starting to loosen as the game progresses. And also, you see a lot of moral repercussions in your relationship with Eleanor, It's a very father-daughter relationship between Delta and Eleanor. And she shapes her own worldview based on what she sees you doing. And at the end of the game, avoiding major spoilers in case anybody does want to play this, how it ends, who she is on emerging from the end of this game depends very much on what you did during the course of the game. And I like that very much. I think that's very neat.
Oh, you mean like she's sort of learning her morals from watching you?
Yes, if you've been a very selfish character, then she kind of turns into a monster.
Oh, wow.
And if you are a kind, loving person, then she wants that to continue to live on through her. And she wants to be a good person and you know, really improve the world through her own actions.
Oh, so. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
That's
very neat.
Because you often see games where there's an attempt to, where you get the kind of, yeah, you know, and then afterwards this happened, affecting the protagonist and sort of taking choice away from the player in a sense, or, you know, putting more weight than it can be realistically be expected onto the player's actions. In, you know, what happens once you put down the controller. But I really like the idea that actually, no, it's a non-player character who, you know, changes and develops according to your actions because they're looking to you for guidance. That's a really good idea.
Absolutely. Just like a real child looks up to their parents, right. Eleanor looks up to who she sees as her daddy, because despite the fact that Sophia Lamb is her mother, there's no love lost there. You know, Lamb was not a loving parent for Eleanor. So she sees her big daddy Delta as her real parent. And that's who influences who she becomes.
Right. Huh.
That's another thing that I love about Bioshock 2 is the fact that Eleanor is such an important character. And this is sort of a very feminist game in a way, because you've got Eleanor as being such an important character. You have your main antagonist is Sophia Lamb, who is a great antagonist without being a trope. And I really enjoy that. She's somebody that I can hate on the basis of her awfulness and not on the basis of her, you know, shallow character arc. And as a girl who plays video games, that's something that we don't always see. And you have another very important sort of female connection in the big sister, who is she is one of the little sisters from the first Bioshock who has grown up.
Oh.
And big sisters are terrifying, let me tell ya.
Okay.
Big sisters are much tougher than big daddies. They have all of these abilities and plasmids and Atom that they absorbed over their years as little sisters collecting, you know, Atom from corpses. And they have these neat suits, dive suits that are sort of more mobile than Big Daddy's. Big Daddy's are heavy and slow. And you, the player, are sort of heavy and slow. And the big sister is fast. She is so mobile. And her suit is much more slender. She can fit in places that a Big Daddy could never go. And you see her popping up all the time. I say her as if she was singular, but there are many big sisters in the game.
Oh, so it isn't just one.
It is many, just in the same way that the Big Daddy is many.
Right.
And the big sisters, you see them popping up everywhere, even outside. You can be looking out a window and see a big sister swimming by in her dive suit. And it's so scary never knowing when one of them is going to pop up. And because they are very tough opponents. They have plasmids, they have weapons, and they are hard to hit, and they hit you very hard.
And are they working under the direction of Lamb then?
Yes, they're under the direction of Lamb. And it's very cool to see these, you know, sort of female opponents. And they also treat female splicers in a very equal way to the male splicers. And that's neat, too. That's something that I appreciate about Bioshock and Bioshock 2 in particular. And Tenenbaum, who is sort of your conscience and your guiding hand through the game, also a very important character.
Right, yes. It is actually, and now that you mention it, even more so than, like, Bioshock 1, the antagonist and the sort of protagonist supporter, the player's mentor, were both male, come to think of it. Whereas here, you're saying that they're both female.
Yes. And in Bioshock Infinite, you have this female character, Elizabeth, who is very widely lauded, you know, as this great independent, you know, female character. But you literally rescue her from a tower.
Right.
She's literally the princess in the tower that you have to rescue. And oh, wow.
That can't be a coincidence, though, surely. I mean, you know, nobody's that oblivious, are they?
I don't know. I kind of feel like people miss that, because that's not something I hear talked about when people talk about Elizabeth in Bioshock Infinite. I don't know. maybe I'm being cynical here, but the sound in Bioshock 2 is incredible, really stupendous. All of the sound, the music, the soundtrack, very good. I actually own the Bioshock 2 soundtrack and play it in my car constantly. It's so good, the music.
Oh, wow. What sort of is it? What is it, classical or?
It's old-timey music. The sort of licensed music, I suppose you would call it. It's there's some ink spots in there and just some different very songs from the 40s.
Oh, I see.
Popular music from the 40s. And a lot of it is daddy themed. I do with that as you will. I don't know. That's a little creepy. But it's very, very good soundtrack. I enjoy that.
But the sound design is good as well.
Yes. Delta, his suit is constantly creaking and groaning as he moves, and his footfalls feel significant. You know, every step is an effort, you can tell, you know, with his lumbering suit. And when he's hit, he makes these sort of whale-like groaning cries. And the big sisters just let out this shriek, this terrifying shriek. It's just gets to you. It's a sound that has that nails on chalkboard quality just enough that it sort of touches something, you know, primal when you hear it, that gives you a dread. And, it's quite good. The sounds that the splicers make, you know, when they don't know you're there yet, you can hear them talking to each other. And it's so funny how the sound can actually guide you to things in this game. I had another little story from my time playing through it recently, because I was sort of replaying it to refresh myself before we did the show. And I heard a toilet flush, and I thought, well, what? And I go looking and I find this bathroom and I think, that's weird. And I go into the bathroom. There's a stall door open. I look in the stall and sure enough, like the water is still swirling. And there is a hypo of Eve on the floor, which is sort of the mana that you use. Eve is mana that you use to power your plasmid abilities. When you have no Eve, you can't use your powers. And I go to reach for this hypo, and it was a trap. There was a splicer behind me who started wailing away with a crowbar.
Oh, wow.
So she actually used that sound to draw me in. I felt pretty sad to have been outsmarted by this this AI.
So would you recommend playing wearing headphones?
Yes, I would recommend playing with headphones. The sound is quite effective.
And they use directional sound. I'm thinking of you saying yes. About this thing with the toilet flush, and you could sort of, presumably that was directional off to one
tell
side.
Tell where it yeah. was, yes.
So what do people say then when you tell them, you know, that you, what do other gamers say when you tell them that you are a big fan of Bioshock 2, you know, as well as Bioshock 1? Because everybody, as we said, Bioshock 1, widely regarded one of the best video games ever. Telling people, oh, I love Bioshock, well, that's not in the least bit controversial. But telling people, and I really like Bioshock 2 as well, that will generally get you some raised eyebrows in the gaming community. So how do people react when you tell them?
Well, you know what I hear the most is, oh, I didn't play it because I heard it was so bad.
Oh, just like me, oh no. Well, no, I didn't hear it was terrible, but I just heard that it was, the reviews I read basically said, it's good, but it doesn't do anything new, and, you know, you've still got all the same aspects of it, the RPG-like aspects with the plasmids and the Adam, and what are they called, the plasmids and the...
The gene tonics?
Tonics, that's the thing, yeah. So you've got with all the plasmids and the tonics and all that stuff that I just wasn't that keen on, to be perfectly honest. And that's why I didn't play. It wasn't because I heard it was bad necessarily.
Right. Well, that's what I hear the most, is that people just didn't play it because it was bad. And most people prefer Bioshock 1, and they always cite the story. And Bioshock 1 did have these amazing plot twists that are absent in Bioshock 2. But the narrative of Bioshock 2 is quite good, as you follow the arc of Delta. It sounded a little ridiculous when I was opening up trying to describe this story, but the arc of Delta and finding out who he is, who he was before he became Big Daddy, is actually quite good. And the narrative that you find in the world in terms of audio logs and environmental storytelling is also very strong. But the real thing that I go to when I am defending my love of Bioshock 2 is the gameplay. The gameplay for Bioshock 2 is head and shoulders above Bioshock 1, and I will fight anybody who says otherwise. In Bioshock 1, you'll recall, there was like a 4-second wait when you had to switch between wielding your plasmid and wielding your weapon. In Bioshock 2, you carry your plasmid in your left hand and your weapon in your right, and you can use them interchangeably.
Oh, so you don't have a drill for a right hand?
You do have the drill, but you can put the drill away and pull out a weapon instead.
Okay. Right.
The drill is just sort of your melee option, and it is the weapon in the game that has the most plentiful ammunition, as it were. It's actually drill fuel, but
right.
it has the same function as ammo. And there are also the rivet gun. You can switch it out for the rivet gun, which, as I said earlier, one of my favorite weapons in all of games. And that has alternative ammo types. There is a shotgun that is extremely fun to wield. And a machine gun. And I believe there are several other types, too, that I'm not thinking of. Oh, there's also a hacking gun. I haven't talked about hacking at all, have I?
No.
The original Bioshock had this sort of plumbing mini game in, because that makes sense. All
yes.
of my computers are powered by, yeah. by running water through pipes. And it's a fun game, the hacking mini game. It's fun, but really, really plumbing. It is very time consuming and tedious. The Bioshock 1 plumbing minigame.
Well, and you know, a cynical man might argue that that's why it's in there, is to make the game last longer.
Indeed.
But I would never say that.
In Bioshock 2, it's a much quicker thing where you have a sort of line going across a grid. And when your line gets to the green, you stop it. And the line moves faster with each stage, and you go through 2 to 5 stages, depending on how difficult the hack is. So it's very quick, and hacking does not pause the game around you. So if you start hacking something while you are being attacked, they will kill you while you are trying to hack this machine, because it's not paused.
Excellent.
And you can distance hack with the use of the hacking darts, and you have this little crossbow, so you can stay in stealth and hit a security camera or a turret before it ever sees you and hack it, and all of the enemies that are in that room will be just wiped out before you even walk in, which is something that I enjoy doing. You can sort of play as a stealth character or a robotics expert in Bioshock 2, which is fun.
I would like to think... The not pausing while you're hacking thing, given that this game came out a couple of years after the first Dead Space, And I would like to think, and I wasn't involved in the actual game design or anything of Dead Space at all, so I can say this with impunity. I would like to think that that was probably taken from there, because while Dead Space almost certainly wasn't the first game to do that, it certainly popularized it amongst sort of mainstream console players, the idea that, yeah, just because you're looking at your map or something, the game doesn't pause and you can still be attacked. So I would like to think that they can, you know, take that as a debt to Dead Space.
I think that's a fair thing to say. I played the original Dead Space, and I find that in terms of atmosphere, I believe Bioshock 2 did crib a bit from Dead Space. Because like Dead Space, it is the most effective when you're anticipating a fight, you know, more sure. than when you're actually in the midst of combat.
That's very true. But I mean, the first Bioshock obviously came out before, while Dead Space was still in development. So, you know, there's all manner of give and take there. But yes, the notion that while you're, as you say, hacking or, yeah, looking at your map, or in the case of Dead Space, sometimes trying to fix a doorway or whatever, that the game doesn't pause and you can still be attacked is, I mean, many other games have done that since, and it is becoming much more common, which I think is a good thing, because it does, in a game like this, it really ramps up the tension in any kind of, I mean, I know the Bioshock games aren't survival horror, but they, you know, the first one had elements of that, certainly.
Yeah, there is a bit of a survival horror feeling to the original Bioshock, for sure. Especially when you're in the very first section, when you're only armed with that wrench.
Right, right, because you are kind of powerless then.
Mm-hmm.
Or you feel it anyway, you feel like you're powerless.
And that's a definite contrast between Bioshock 2 and the original. You never feel powerless in Bioshock 2. You definitely feel like there are things in the world that are much meaner than you are. But you are a big daddy. You are this hulking creature in this suit with this drill for a hand, and you never feel powerless. So that is a big change.
Right. It's like the difference. Well, it's like the difference between a survival horror and, I don't know, a game like Call of Duty or something, which,
yeah,
you know, I mean, the survival horror goes back a long way, but you could argue was created, and it has been argued, was created as a sort of antithesis to those games where you play, you know, a commando or a ninja, mm-hmm. or some kind of, you know, Arnie-like mercenary covered in bullets and bandoliers and, you know, carrying 10 guns, but somehow still being able to move stealthily.
Right, right. It is pretty ridiculous that you can play so stealthily in your giant Big Daddy suit. But I do think they did have a more shooter sort of idea in mind when they created Bioshock 2, because it does, combat is fast and clean, and it does have a very shooter sort of a feel.
Well, I think that's okay. That brings us to the commercial success stroke reception of it, which is something that we see this a lot in games, and we saw this in the Dead Space franchise as well, where a game is, well, in the case of the original Bioshock, actually very successful. But even if the game is, you know, say, quite successful, there is then this strange pressure to be even more successful with a sequel.
Right.
And commonly, the root, you know, the sort of the perceived wisdom is that the route to that is to make it more like games that sell even better. So you take something like, I mean, in the case of Dead Space, you know, it sold, I think it was 1.5 million copies, the first game took. And I'm only using that as an example because obviously, you know, I sort of was quite close to it, so I saw all this happening. The first one sold, I think, 1.5 million lifetime copies by the end, which is quite good, but obviously not going to be a huge money spinner for a big, expensive game. And so for the sequels, it was like, okay, make it a bit more like a shooter, because everybody's playing Call of Duty. They're selling 20 million copies. You know, if they can do that because they're a shooter, maybe if we make Dead Space more like a shooter, we can get some of that audience. But it never works, you know, and we've seen it time and time again with many, many games that aren't shooters trying to become more like shooters in their sequels. And it never works because the existing audience is annoyed, and the audience you're trying to get go, well, I'm not going to play that because that's not my favorite shooter game. And it sounds like they did a little bit of that with Bioshock 2, which is a shame, really.
Yes. And that's a perfect segue into the multiplayer.
Ah, yes.
The tacked-on multiplayer mode for Bioshock 2.
Right, which was not in Bioshock 1, of course.
Correct. Bioshock 1 was a single-player-only game, so was Bioshock Infinite. And Bioshock 2 had a tacked-on multiplayer mode. Was it tacked on? Yes. Was it a Call of Duty ripoff? Yes. Was it still pretty fun? Yes.
Fair enough.
I enjoyed the Bioshock 2 multiplayer. I'm not really a huge multiplayer girl, so I didn't play it for that long. But it was very fun. It was modeled after the Modern Warfare multiplayer, which was, of course, a juggernaut. And you basically just, you know, ran around shooting at each other, except you could also set each other on fire sometimes, too, which was fun.
And wait, so were you all playing Big Daddies or Splicers?
No, you were playing Splicers. Right, you were all playing Splicers. And there, I remember a game mode. I wasn't able to play this recently for a refresher because nobody's playing Bioshock 2 multiplayer.
Are the servers even still online? Yeah.
I'm not sure if the servers are even up. But I remember a game mode in which a Big Daddy suit would appear on the map and whoever could get to it first would become Big Daddy.
Oh, so like quad damage in Quake or something?
Right, like Juggernaut mode in Halo, or...
That's a much more modern reference, well done.
I believe Call of Duty also has a Juggernaut mode.
Right.
And it was a loadout-based multiplayer, much like Call of Duty, but it did have that pickup power weapons. It were pickup-based, so you could find those on the map and wreak some havoc. It was pretty fun to play. It didn't have the legs that other multiplayer games do because people don't play Bioshock for multiplayer.
Right.
They play it for the story and the atmosphere. But it was a fun multiplayer, and I don't feel that it took anything away from the main game. So.
Right. I mean, they took plenty of time to sort of make it and put it out there anyway. It was 4 years between the first game and this, so it's not like... Because sometimes there is an argument, and, you know, sometimes it is true, that resources are taken away from a single-player game in order to make the multiplayer, because they think that will shift another, you know, an extra 500,000 units or whatever. But I don't think you can really argue that was the case here, because 4 years of development for single-player, that's more than enough. If you can't get a game right, especially a sequel, right in 4 years, you know, you're probably doing something wrong.
Right, I agree.
But they apparently expected this. Take-Two expected this game to sell 5 million copies, which is 1 million more than Bioshock 1.
That's a ton of copies. I was not aware of that.
That's insane, isn't it? The thing is, it did sell 3 million.
Which is really good.
That's amazing. I know. But that wasn't enough. That wasn't enough. It's crazy. Yeah, and that's why it's regarded as a commercial failure. Because it didn't sell what Take-Two... It didn't meet Take-Two's sales expectations.
That is just bananas to me.
But yeah, those expectations seem completely out of whack with reality to me.
Yeah, I agree. They were a little overly ambitious with that.
It's crazy. So you mentioned the DLC right at the top. Minerva's Den, it was called, I believe, yeah?
Right. There were actually two DLCs. The first one was called Protector Trials.
Oh, I didn't know about that one.
You play in Protector Trial. In neither of these DLCs do you play as Delta, but you do play as other Alpha Series Big Daddies. In Protector Trials, I believe you play as Theta, and I'm probably wrong about that. I apologize if I'm wrong. But you play as Theta, and Tenenbaum has tasked you with gathering some Atom to keep it out of the hands of Sophia Lam. And it's basically just a bunch of playgrounds for you to set up these elaborate traps with different loadouts of plasmids and weapons and trap abilities and do the Atom gathering sort of as a mini game, which was very fun. There's not much real story there. And that's why you've never heard of it. It was very largely forgotten. I don't think a ton of people played it.
Right, it's just a gameplay DLC. It's like getting extra puzzle levels in Portal or something.
Right. I think it could be sort of compared to the Clash in the Clouds DLC for Bioshock Infinite, which was also sort of lampooned as a bad idea.
Right.
But I did enjoy Protector Trials. It was more Atom gathering, which was fun. But it could have been much, you know, more fleshed out, much better. And then along came Minerva's Den. which is widely thought of as one of the best pieces of DLC that's ever happened. And I would have to say that's a pretty good assessment of Minerva's Den. It's similar to Bioshock 2 narratively in some ways. It does have, though, some of those big twists and shocking moments that you see in the narrative of Bioshock 1. And I would say that even if you're not really interested in playing Bioshock 2, it would be worth the price of entry to buy Bioshock 2 so that you can play Minerva's Den.
Wow. Well, especially these days as well. Bioshock 2, you can probably get it on Steam for, what, $10, if not less?
I think so. It's always going on Steam sales for $2.50, $5,
right, yeah.
Something like that. So I'd highly recommend when you see it on one of those sales, pick it up, even if you only want to play Minerva's Den. It's a very tight narrative in which you follow the story of Sigma, I believe, is the big daddy that you play. And you learn so much about... it's great for lore. I don't want to spoil Minerva's Den. I really think everyone listening should go out and play Minerva's Den. It's quite good. And it was actually directed by Steve Gaynor, who is now has his own studio, Fulbright, and made Gone Home, which is widely lauded for its narrative.
And yeah. For its environmental storytelling gameplay. I was going to bring this up, yes. In fact, not just Steve, but all three of the founding members of the Fulbright company worked on Bioshock 2.
Right.
I know Steve worked on Minerva's Den. I'm not sure if the others did. But yes, I know a couple of those guys. So yes, I was going to bring that up, but I'm glad you did.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think I may be mistaken, but I think several of the team went with him to Fulbright.
Yeah, well, like I say, certainly the founders did, yes.
But it's quite good. The narrative is very tight. Audiologues are very good. It's a shorter experience than Bioshock 2. It's sort of like all the things that are good about Bioshock 2 are sort of condensed into Minerva's Den, and they pull out some of the things that people said, hey, you know, this was one of the reasons I loved the original Bioshock, and I wish this had been in Bioshock 2. Okay, let's pluck those out. Let's put those in Minerva's Den too. And, yeah, you have this great exploration and a very tight story with some great twists and some great combat. There are new plasmids in Minerva's Den. And if you like experimenting with robots, this is for you.
Experimenting with robots.
Yeah, there's definitely some great robot stories and experiences that you can have with sort of the robotics computers and turrets and stuff. You sort of meet the computer that is responsible for keeping Rapture running, basically. The computer that keeps the lights on and powers all those security cameras, and it's very interesting.
All right, so let's get into the close of this then. What would you say to persuade people that they should, especially if they have played Bioshock 1 but didn't play Bioshock 2, so people like me, give us a condensed, you know, a quick, why should they play Bioshock 2 in summary?
All of these people who are telling you that Bioshock 2 is terrible, I'd say a large proportion of them have not given the game a chance, and that you should be a forward-thinking, independent-minded fellow and try it for yourself before you make that conclusion. I would also say that the gameplay is king in Bioshock 2, and it's much more fun to actually play than Bioshock, the original. And I would also say that the most important thing to me in a game is atmosphere. What does the world make you feel? And if you are someone who enjoys atmosphere in a game, you will enjoy Bioshock 2.
Hmm. Okay, those last two actually do, they fall right within my wheelhouse. Because, I mean, I admit I played the first Bioshock on PS3, so, you know, commence jokes about the controls and you know, trying to play a game like that with dual thumbsticks compared to keyboard and mouse, but what can I say, I'm a Mac user, so that, you know, I didn't have an awful lot of choice. And one of the things about it was, as I said, yeah, the gameplay wasn't an awful lot of fun for me. Mm-hmm. So maybe Maybe I should give Bioshock 2 a try then. And atmosphere certainly is, you know, something that I always look for in a game.
And, you know, if you're really not that interested in the sort of RPG elements of customizing your character through plasmids and gene tonics, you can totally skip all that. It's more optional in Bioshock 2 than it was in the original Bioshock, because as a big daddy, you are a little bit more durable.
Right, so you're more powerful just to start with, without having to sort of min-max everything in order to just make it to the end of the game.
Yes.
Okay, well, that's good. I've never liked min-maxing, even in my pen and paper role-playing games. But yeah, that's very interesting. So thank you, Shalene, for coming on and telling us about that. Where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
Well, if you like hearing me talk about video games, you are in luck. You can hear me talk about the Fallout series on the Fallout Off the Record podcast, which we record every week. And also, I have a new podcast called KD Radio that is a sort of general gaming podcast. And there, I do Let's Plays and streams occasionally on the YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/QuestGamingNetwork. I am also on Twitter at Shalene L, S-H-A-L-I-N-E-L.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. You can check out my comics, books, and music at anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find information and links to all of my work. You can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. Go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up, and check the box for Unjustly Maligned when you choose which shows to support. You can also help by reviewing Unjustly Maligned on iTunes and following us on Twitter at UMPFM. Finally, the show notes for this episode are at ump.fm. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. I can't believe I made a Quake reference. Really showing my
age. Well, hey, you're timely again. They've announced a sort of revival of Quake with Quake Champions.
Oh, I hadn't heard anything about this. What's that?
Yeah, at the E3, at the Bethesda press conference, they opened with a video of Quake Champions, which is sort of what they're doing with the Quake license now. I believe it's going to be sort of a like a hero shooter, like a character shooter. Where you have, you know, your loadout based on what character you choose.
Oh, right.
Yeah, go from there.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they didn't release a ton of details, just sort of a teaser trailer.
Currently set for release on Windows. Bah.
I followed you on Goodreads because of Wasteland.
Oh, right.
And there was like a Goodreads post, and I was like, I like podcasts. And I think the one, I don't remember what the first one I heard was, but it was something that I loved that everybody hates. And that's how I found your show.
As I say, I was going to bring up the Fulbright Gone Home connection, because I'm not sure if everybody's aware of it. But yes, obviously Steve and those guys, they all worked on Bioshock 2. And yeah, I'm not sure if they all worked on Minerva's Den, but I got to know them because I did some work for 2K.
Okay.
Not on the Bioshock series, on the ill-fated first-person XCOM reboot.
Oh, yeah, that looked cool.
At one time it was, but...
I remember the original reveal looked cool.
Well, but unfortunately, that original reveal was what sent everything into a spiral, because the general reaction was not good at all. But that was where I met Carla Zimonia. Who is now, you know, was one of the founders of Fulbright. And also where I met Jordan Thomas, who directed Bioshock 2, and then went, he's now doing Magic Circle, if you saw that.
No.
It's a PC-only game about, it's a game about a game that was never finished. Lost in development hell and never got finished. It's really, really good and surreal and, yeah.
That sounds clever.
It is, yeah.